sunny for the morning, then cloudy and mild with a 30% chance of rain for the afternoon. Today's high, 63 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Here are the numbers now. Wind north at 6. Sunshine, 50 degrees Kenosha, 46 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Bird is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am excited to welcome into our studios today, first of all, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage, Dr. Herschel Kruger, who is professor of theater at Carthage. Is that it? Theater or theatrical arts?
No, we're theater and dance.
Theater and dance. Very good. I get Carthage and Parkside mixed up with the nomenclature. So, professor of theater and dance at Carthage College, and two of his students are joining him today as well. Annie Gebauer, who is a senior theater major, and Katie Leyendecker, who is a junior theater major. And all three of them are deeply immersed in what sounds like a production of a truly fascinating play called On the Verge, or The Geography of Yearning, by Eric Overmeyer. And this play is going to be opening this coming weekend, running for this weekend and the next. Annie, is it Annie? Am I pronouncing
it's
that right?
Annie.
Annie, sorry about that. Annie is the costume designer for this production, and this is actually serving as her senior thesis. Katie Leyendecker is the assistant director and dramaturge for this production, and we'll be talking about what both of those responsibilities entail. And again, On the Verge by Eric Overmeyer is opening, is it Friday night? Yes,
correct.
Opening Friday night. Don't want to steal you from one probably much-needed last rehearsal before you open. So Friday night at Carthage College in Wartburg Auditorium. So a warm welcome to all three of you. Glad to have you with us on the morning show today.
Good morning, Greg.
So first of all, what do things feel like at this point in time with opening
night?
We're
all tired, but you know, it's been a challenging process, because as soon as we got rolling and started putting all of our technical elements into it, we had spring break. We knew it was coming. We tried to prepare for it, but that is something you think will work, and then you come back and then you make adjustments. But we had a really good run last night, and I think we'll be in really good shape after another two more dress rehearsals before we open.
Mm. I guess because spring break moves around, sometimes you aren't saddled with that that problem in the calendar.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the continuity is tough for everyone. The actors, you know, and the momentum you get just in combining all the elements together, and you know, all the things you talk about in production meetings, and you start implementing them, and then you put everything on a hold. So, you know, it's just kind of getting rolling again. But we're full steam ahead now.
Very good. So, explain how this particular play showed up in your season, and yeah. and maybe even why it showed up now.
Yeah, so this is this time slot is usually not a new play, but contemporary works. We try to find something that will appeal to people for whatever reasons they are. And we had a couple other plays selected, but we also wanted to find a period piece for Ani for her senior thesis as a costume designer. She had a couple of, already had a couple of contemporary plays within her portfolio. And so we had to find a contemporary play with a period costume design. And there are about five or six plays we considered, and this is where we landed. So that was an important reason, but also within the group of plays we read, we wanted to make sure we found something that was engaging and challenging, and boy, it's been all of those things.
I should imagine. And yeah, it occurs to me that here we have three characters who are rooted in Victorian England, but this is, as you say, a relatively modern play. I think it had its first performance in 1985.
Correct.
So it does serve those two criteria very, very well. Could we talk for a moment about Eric Overmeyer, who is the playwright? And he sounds like someone with an exceptionally interesting resume, in that probably a lot of people, if they know the name, know it from his long line of successes in television, I mean, and major television.
Yes.
But who also has this other side of him that is intriguing.
You know, you see his name pop up in different, you know, television or movies as a screenwriter, and you're like, oh, so his work is prolific. But I was first introduced to him on a play that my wife was designing called In Perpetuity Throughout the Universe. And just the title, you know, is something that I think draws you in. Like, what does that even mean? I had read this play years ago, and I've seen scenes from it, but I've never tried to tackle it. And you know, a lot of productions are still done of this play, and we do start in the Victorian era, and through the magic of theater, we progress in time. They are time travelers, or they call themselves, well, first they're polytopians, and they say travelers to many lands, and they come upon this fictional land of Terra Incognita, which no one has, it's the last bit of undiscovered earth or something like that. And as they start traversing, weird vocabulary pops up in their conversations, and items appear, and all these other strange things start happening, and it takes a while, but of course then they figure out, wait, we are, something unique is happening here. And so that's really, really fun, and it gives us a lot of flexibility. So we start in 1888, but the forward action takes us to this magical and fictional world, and gives us a lot of flexibility to play with creativity and just to make different choices. So, you know, this kind of writing is daunting, but it's also, if you just open up to it, it's really inviting to make these kind of choices, and some of them work and some of them don't.
Right. But yeah, I should think in terms of just the creative opportunities it allows you, it's so exciting. Mm-hmm. And I guess just to go back to Mr. Overmeyer, I found myself pleasantly surprised, I guess. I mean, mm-hmm. when I see, he wrote for Homicide and St. Elsewhere and mm-hmm. Law and Order and so on. So I'm expecting this to be sort of straightforward and maybe even a little simplistic in the way that we sometimes think of television often being, I mean, kind of mainstream television shows are not mm-hmm. usually the last word in sophistication and complication and so on. I mean, like the play you just described, I can't imagine that being on major network television, for instance.
Yeah.
And so I just think it's really interesting that the same guy who has all of these rather standard, though excellent, television mm-hmm. credits is creating a play like this.
Yeah, I mean, the play is I used the word daunting before, and I really mean that in the sense of just to understand the play mm-hmm. and the language, the vocabulary and the syntax of the characters. I mean, I started with the list, and Katie is a dramaturge, and she could speak to this a little. I mean, we just, our vocabulary list just kept getting longer and longer. It's like, wait, what does that mean? What does that line mean? Because you put it all together, it's like, we know what these words mean individually, but then you put it together, it's like, oh. So we did a bit of table work, and you know, Katie did a lot of work with both understanding the word and then its use in context. So,
wow. So daunting is the word, and I can well imagine that. Let's talk to our two students for a moment about your respective roles in this production. Again, we're talking about Eric Overmeyer's play On the Verge, or The Geography of Yearning, which is a play that is going to open this coming Friday evening at Carthage College. So, Ani Gabar, let's talk to you first and pull that mic right up to you, okay? So you are the costume designer for this production. First of all, let's find out a little bit about what kind of prompted your interest in costume design. And when you came to Carthage as a freshman, was that central focus already well in place?
So I have always loved clothes. Even as like a little kid, when other kids would be like drawing houses or stick figures, I would be drawing dresses. So it's always something that's been a part of my life. And when I got to college, I realized like, this is something I can do for a job. Why not? And it's so much fun. I love it so much.
So you learned when you got to Carthage that this was a possibility, or even ahead of that, were you already thinking that way?
I had done some theater costume design in high school, but I hadn't thought of it as a serious career option until I got to college.
Right. So you've worked closely, obviously, with the amazing Kim Instanis. So what kind of work have you done ahead of this, and how does this particular project or undertaking differ from the things you've done before?
So this is the third show that I've costume designed at Carthage, and it is the second show that's been on the main stage, and it is by far the biggest project that I've had, but it's been the most fun. I love doing historical research, and there's been a lot of that in this show. My past shows were both modern shows. I did Constellations and Memento Mori were the others that I costume designed.
Great. We'll dig into some of the specifics of what this show has meant for you. Professor Kruger, maybe you can explain what it means when somebody is designing a show and it is their senior thesis. What's involved in that beyond the actual design of the costumes?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a capstone. So Ani is a costume design major. It's one of the different courses of study you could take in the theater department. And, of course, she's not about to do a senior thesis in performance. So she's been working towards this with in the capacity of the costume designer. She already talked about the research component of it. And then looking not just at the Victorian period, but as we move forward, without giving too much away, we do come into a more present time period. So that is, you know, the foundation and the beginning of the work. But then, you know, a lot of costumes are built. So there's fabric selection. Then you have to make sure you can find it and buy the right amounts. And then there's all the patterning and cutting and draping and measuring and fittings. And mock-ups. I mean, there's a ton of work that goes into it as well. So as she is the designer and conceptually putting it together, she's also working in the shop with all the other students and her faculty mentor and implementing the design then in time so it's ready for, you know, our first dress rehearsals, which started two nights ago. And we're down to a pretty solid punch list, but it looks incredible. Kind of segueing away from her work, but I think the other part of it is how can we take the design aspect and the historical research, but then make it work for what we need to do on stage with it, right? Because sometimes, like, the women are all in corsets. Right, but how can they move freely and how can they breathe and everything? And there's some other requirements, the things I don't want to give away, but how can we accessorize certain parts of the costumes for very important and required props and other things that you traditionally wouldn't have in costumes of this period. Mm.
So in other words, it's not just about being completely realistic or authentic.
Correct.
It's about what's going to work on stage and work in this production and so on. So thinking practically.
And under the demands of what's in the script.
Right.
So we need to carry that out, but still contain all of the historical research, but it has to work for us to do the play.
Right. The word daunting comes to mind once again. So Ani Gabar is the designer of the costumes. Katie Leyendecker, who is a junior theater major, is the assistant director and the dramaturge for this production. So let's talk about what those two roles entail. So first of all, I suppose the role of assistant director probably can vary from production to production, depending on who the director happens to be. So how is it working in this particular instance?
Well, it started with Herschel and I kind of talking through some things. It was clear that I would get to direct a scene or two. I got to run a couple of rehearsals under Herschel and on my own, which was nice. So it's been stuff like that. It's a lot of Herschel going, hey, what do you think about this? And how do you think this is working? Or I have an idea and I'll be like, hey, Herschel, maybe we should try something like this. And he's like, oh, yeah, let's go for it. So it's a very collaborative process. And it's also a really good learning opportunity because as assistant director, I can be like, hey, Herschel, I'm not really sure if I understand how this part of directing works. Can you explain it? Or I get to watch a lot of the technical elements from behind the scenes without having to be like, hey, I don't fully understand tech right now. So can I just watch and see what this means for the future if I ever get to direct a professional production anywhere or something like that? It's really nice to learn and also be fully involved at the same time.
Right. I love that balance. So I imagine it maybe depends also on the production and who your assistant director happens to be. Yeah. And maybe various faculty members tend to maybe function differently with their assistant director?
Yeah. I mean, and it's a relationship that, you know, you have to just trust each other. And there are times where I'm, like, taking notes on a lot of tech stuff and other things that are going on, and Katie will sit by me in rehearsal, and I might just whisper a note to her, and she'll write it down, or she'll say, what do you think about that? And I'll be, oh, yeah, give them that note. And even after, like, rehearsal, I might spend time talking with, you know, lighting and costume designers and sound and projection designer and going through stuff, and Katie go and give the notes. I trust her that whatever notes I've conveyed to her or her own thoughts about it, we've worked together enough that I don't have to worry like what she's going to tell the actors afterward. I think there'll be specificity. It'll be congruent with everything we've been working on. And sometimes it's nice to also have a peer voice, right? Instead of this old guy telling you stuff that, you know, she might say the same thing. She might use just a slightly different nuance or tone, and it lands with the actors maybe a little differently, although essentially we might say the same thing. So, yeah, it's been a good experience. And I've done this with several students over the years. Mm-hmm. And I learn as much by working with her where I have to step back sometimes too and go, wait, what is my process? What am I doing? What example am I setting here? So it's a good way to check in with yourself.
Very good. Katie, have you been an assistant director before at Carthage?
Or I have not. This is the first time I have assistant directed anything ever. Mm. I took Herschel's directing class in the fall, which is kind of the prelude to this. You learn how to direct and things like that and how it's a very collaborative process. And then Herschel was like, hey, do you want to assistant direct and dramaturge on The Verge? And I was like, I totally do.
Mm-hmm. So let's explore this other term, which I think will be much less familiar, might be completely alien to maybe most of our listeners, actually, this thing called the dramaturge.
Mm-hmm.
So explain your understanding of what that means, to be a dramaturge, and what it has meant for you in this specific production.
Yeah. So a dramaturge is essentially a research assistant for the director if there's anything that they need to know about the show and things like that, especially for period pieces like this one. It's kind of like, okay, what does this word mean? That's a lot of checking things and knowing, what does this word mean? What is the context of this thing that's happening historically and demographically, geographically? You know, there's a lot of places that they're talking about, and it's like, okay, where is this place? What does that mean that they've been to the Congo or that they've been in all of these different locales? And it's also trying to know a little bit of what the playwright had intended with the show. So it was a lot of researching some of the women that inspired the show. So like Nellie Bly, a very famous journalist, and Amelia Earhart, a famous aviator, you know, knowing things like that. But for me, it was also getting together with Herschel beforehand, and he was like, okay, so we know that women are a cornerstone of this play, right? It's about three women navigators. So he was like, can we find more women, right? There has to be more women in history that have done these really interesting things. And he really said, just find them as far back as you can and as recent as you can. Although my cutoff was 1888 when the show starts. So I spent a lot of time getting to know women in history that people might not know about that can help not only our actors, but maybe some of our audience members be like, oh, wow, women are awesome. And learn a little bit more about the history of the time.
So how is that information conveyed to the audience? I mean, what difference does that ultimately make for the audience that's going to see this?
Well, you know, there's the lighthearted stuff about the wearing of pants or trousers and the use of slang, and especially as these new words and ideas appear in their heads, which they don't have any idea or control over. Two more serious topics that you know can be about a women's place in their relationship. So one of the characters married. One of the characters is married, and it's about her relationship with her husband. The other characters, the subjects in which they study are taboo for. For their society and even for them to be polytopians and travelers and then also their role within societies and in societies meaning both the society they come from in the past and the present and what's possible in the future. So I think, you know, as Katie pointed out, of course we're aware there are all these amazing women who were doing these things, but we don't know them because they aren't as easily recorded or set down as you know, icons of navigation and discovery and stuff. But it just takes a little digging, and there's a lot more there, and you're like, oh yeah, okay. And a couple of names I was familiar with, and some were brand new to me. And Katie's also put together a dramaturgy packet for our audience and created something really nice that you'll be able to see in the lobby display as you come in, and then has added other elements to the show in the pre-show with inspirational quotes and of course pointing things out to me along the way that I should make sure I consider that, you know, especially having the male viewpoint and focus, just to make sure I understand that everything that I'm doing is in support and comes from the text, and that it is clearly communicated both by how I work with the actors, but then what the actors express. Yeah. So,
is it a happy accident that this play is being performed during Women's History Month?
Yes, it is. It is a happy accident. Yeah,
a happy one indeed. For those of you just joining us, we're talking today on the morning show about a really fascinating play that is about to open at Carthage College in the Wartburg Auditorium. It's called On the Verge, or The Geography of Yearning, by Eric Overmeyer. And it centers on the experience of three women explorers, Victorian women explorers, Mary, Alex, and Fanny, and what they encounter as they explore this strange landscape called Terra Incognita. And along the way, they encounter eight different interesting, intriguing, mysterious figures or beings. So, Katie, let's turn to you for just a moment. These eight different characters or beings, according to the playwright, are supposed to be played by the same actor.
Mm-hmm.
And is that what's happening in this production?
Yes, that is what's happening in this production. We have freshman Matthew Andressen playing all of those eight characters, and he's doing a phenomenal job. It was a lot of talking about, okay, how do we make this person different from this person? Because some of them are so different that you're like, wow, that's crazy that Eric Overmeyer even came up with them. And some of them are like, okay, cool, how do we make this guy different from this guy, right? And it's really interesting. And it was a lot of research on his part, too, because some of them might be real people. I don't know. I guess you'd have to see it to figure out which real people they might be playing. So that was really important for Matthew and for Herschel and I to talk about with him of, like, okay, how do you stand like this person who's real? And how do you speak like this person who's not? So that was a lot of fun to work with him on that.
Right. Well, and you said these guys, but actually they're not all mm-hmm. male beings either, and maybe mm-hmm. in a couple cases we don't know exactly what they are. But
right.
This is an interesting coincidence. Just yesterday I was talking with someone from the Lakeside Players who are doing the 39 Steps that mm-hmm. opens this weekend, and I only mention it because that is a play in which probably 30 different roles are mm-hmm. played by a couple of different actors, and that must be an especially interesting and challenging theatrical device when you have a given actor doing multiple roles.
Yeah, it is really challenging. I mean, as Katie talked about in our process, we're trying to find the center for each of Matthew's characters, and then maybe trying to find something different about the way they spoke or how they would stand or where they would, how they would gesture. And then we started using some simple rehearsal costumes, but this last week's been really great because I think it's taken Matthew now to the final step that he gets to continue exploring as an actor, adding the costume pieces, because mm-hmm. those just give him so much more to work on. And I think it's like a freedom to go a little bit further with each of the characters, and I think he has a lot of fun with it. It is one of the other daunting parts of this play. It's also, I think, one of the funnier things, because once we get into the convention and by his third character, you're like, oh, who's he going to come out in next? And sometimes it's like scene, next page, he's on again as somebody else. And you're like, oh.
Mm.
And that's kind of fun. And there's a couple of tight changes that have to happen. And Ani and her crew have, they plotted it out and figured out how we thought it would work. And then we had to practice it like anything else. And it's working real well.
Interesting. I read that these eight, and I've described in different ways, sometimes not even described as characters, more like beings or strange, mysterious figures or whatever. But that my understanding is that the script is not terribly specific, or not as specific as they might be with a standard character, and that there is a certain amount of artistic license that is granted to anybody who does this play in terms of shaping the specifics of these eight characters. Is that right? And
yeah,
how have you handled
yeah,
them?
Yeah, I think it's I think it's very accurate, and there's little clues, and we have to like go back to the text and see like what can we latch onto here, and then if not, what are we going to base it on? And we had different talks about who one character might be, mm-hmm. and how we can reference them. Or we had another character where we had to talk about the appropriateness of their presentation and how we wanted to present them. You know, from the play that was written now almost 40 years ago, the way we want to present characters on stage, we just wanted to make sure that we didn't have anything that would be offensive and or inconsiterate.
Right. Mm-hmm. Boy, that makes me old. Feel old to think that this play from 1985 is 40 years old.
Yeah.
That's just crazy. So, Ani, we need to circle back to you, particularly because of a couple of things Professor Kruger mentioned in terms of the costumes and what a significant difference they have made for this young student who's playing all these eight characters. But of course, the costumes matter in every single respect. Tell us, though, specifically about these eight mysterious beings and designing their costumes and what that process was like, particularly given the fact that the script does not maybe give you the kind of specific information that it might give you about somebody else. And what was that process like, and was that a series of decisions you were making alone or in collaboration with others?
So during the production meetings and process, I had a lot of talks with Herschel and the other production team members about who we really wanted these characters to be, because as previously stated, we don't have a ton of information on them. But I got to do some historical research on them. Some of them, there's no historical basis for, so it's kind of using the imagination and how we want to present them. So it was a lot of sketching, a lot of imagination, and then figuring out how to make it all work. Because there are some really quick changes, and figuring out how to completely change from this one character to the next in like 30 seconds, was a really fun challenge.
I hadn't even really thought about that, but that I suppose that is indeed something a costume designer has to think about. Are those kind of logistics? Have you had to think about that before, or is this a first to have to think about designing costumes that will work effectively in really quick changes?
So I've done a little bit of some work with some quick changes, but this has been the most intensive, and these have been the quickest changes that I've done. And it's been really fun figuring out, like, how do I make this shirt with all these buttons able to come on and off? And those, like, little things that people don't even really think about.
Let's talk about the three women explorers, Alex, Fanny, and Mary, who are from the Victorian era. And as Professor Kruger has already touched on, the Victorian period suggests certain specifics to which you probably have to remain faithful, and then other ways in which you need to maybe vary from what actually would have been worn. Tell us more about what these three women are going to be wearing, and also what you had to think about in terms of each of them, so they're not just three generic Victorian women, but three distinct characters, because my understanding is they have distinct personalities, one from the other.
Yes, they are very distinct. So my first step with this was historical research, because I needed to be very familiar with the period. And after that, I really did a lot of character analysis and thinking, who is this person and how would that translate into the Victorian fashion? And one of the characters, I gave her a bow on almost every costume. And that's kind of her thing. And one of the characters is a bit more straightforward and practical. And how do I transform that into being visible on her clothes, and not even just modern clothes, but her Victorian clothes?
What's it like to work with this particular period? I mean, is it particularly fun? I mean, as a costume designer, or is it so sort of tightly focused that it doesn't give you the room that maybe other periods do, where there's a wider variance of what is possible?
I actually really like the Victorian period. The bustles are so much fun, and we've got some really great drapey moments on the skirts. But as this show sort of progresses in time, I get a lot more freedom with how to costume the characters, because I have a wider variety of time periods as we move in the show. So I think even though the first part is a bit limiting with the Victorian period, it's such a wide-ranging show.
Wow. So that I didn't realize. I mean, I knew that there was this sense that as they continue to explore this terra incognita, that they are actually also traveling into the future and seeing various examples of the future world, if you will. But I never stopped to think about them being dressed differently. So what they wear evolves as well as they continue this exploration into the future. I mean, they are garbed in more and more modern clothing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, in a way, they do change as they progress and as their characters develop. Yeah.
Yeah. I think Annie's careful not to give much away, but that's okay. We do move into the future. That's easily found. I think one of the things she's being really humble about is, as you stated, like this Victorian garb, and especially these women who are out on safari, it could be really cookie cutter. It would look just like this. And even for myself, I had a hard time thinking about how to differentiate them in 1888. Mm. So I started with just some of my own ideas about who they were and what they'd look like in the most forward period of time, where I could more readily identify their characters, their personalities, and some of those different things. And what Ani has so wonderfully captured is that exact same idea in their Victorian costumes. So whether it's the bow or the fabric she uses, or how ornate it might be, or how simplified some of it might be, there are different cuts and different lines and things like that we see with the characters, because they are very slightly in age, with Mary being the oldest and Alex being the youngest. Mm. So who's a little more youthful, or you know, how do they express themselves through their clothing? And when you see them in their Victorian costumes, they are very specific and just as nuanced and detailed as how we more easily understand them, seeing them in, through a lens that we're more readily able to make identification of personality traits and such.
Huh, very good. Katie Leyendecker, I have read someplace that the language of this play predominantly is esoteric.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about that, if that sounds like an apt description, and tell our listeners more about the kind of language that they will hear in this play. And does that evolve over time as the story progresses forward in more ways than one?
Yeah, the language was definitely one of the biggest parts about this show. Like Herschel and I have kind of been saying, like, it was a lot of knowing what words mean and what they mean together, because there's a lot of words where we're like, oh, I kind of know what that word means. And then you have to think, but wait, what does it actually mean? Like, if somebody asked me what this word means, could I tell them? And then what does that word mean when I'm saying it like this? Or language changes too, right? So there's plenty of words that in 1888 still exist today but do not mean the same thing. So then it's looking at your actors and saying, okay, I know you think you know what this word means, but also it's 1888. This word actually means something different. And like I said too, like the geographical locations, it's a lot of knowing what, first of all, how to pronounce the geographical location, because some of them look really straightforward, and then you're like, oh, not quite. There's like a little bit more emphasis on the A or the Y or something like that. But then also, as they kind of travel through time, they learn new words. And to us, we're like, okay, that's a word we all know because it's a super modern word, but to someone who's a Victorian woman, what does it mean that they suddenly know this really strange, odd word? And so it's almost working in reverse, right? You go from, we don't know what some of those older words mean, to, okay, now I know what this word means, but they don't. So how do we have them react to not knowing what this word means? Or how might one character think, wow, that's a really cool thing that I know, versus another character being like, oh, I don't know if I like this new thing that exists, right? So it's a lot
I don't want to know this.
Right, exactly. And so that's something we kind of played with. And we're still finding things where sometimes I'm like, oh, I don't know how I missed this. We've been getting this all wrong. And that's okay. I think that's the fun thing about language. I'm also an English major, so this is kind of right up my alley, and a Victorianist. Yeah. So I've kind of been loving knowing what these words mean and learning a little bit more, and thinking about how these women are interacting with each other and working together in this time period using language.
Right. And not to belabor the point, but I remain just kind of astonished that this person, well known for writing for Law and Order and St. Elsewhere and, you know, shows like that, is also writing this play that's rooted in the Victorian era and using language in such an innovative way. I'm just really impressed by that, and makes me all the more intrigued to see this. Tell us visually what the stage is going to look like, because, I mean, speaking of daunting, I mean, this is a complicated story, and it probably is not the easiest thing to bring alive visually on the stage.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, I don't know.
He writes 22 scenes in 20 or 19 different locations.
Wow.
And sometimes you're also in one geographical location and ecosystem, and the next scene you're somewhere else, or you're deeper into the jungle. So there's like four or five jungle scenes, but not one part of the jungle is the same. So it's always evolving. And then you're like in a completely different ecosystem. So and sometimes the scenes are two pages, and then boom, you just got to be in your next place. And there's not like, you know, Shakespeare, oh, here we are in the Forest of Arden, right? And we don't make those pronouncements. You know, they do talk about it. It's like, oh, I hate this part of the jungle. This isn't, you know, my area. But we've already established we're in the jungle, but then we're somewhere else, and then we're somewhere else. And so we've tried to do something that's Maureen Chavez Kruger, my better half, is our scenic designer, and we had lots of discussions about how this would be, and we came up with this very wide expanse that we can use projections on or not, and transform into multiple places pretty readily. You know, we ask the audience to come on a journey with us, much like the characters are on this journey. So both the audience and the actors are discovering together, embracing the unknown together, and hopefully we, you know, are able to, you know, what's the term we always use to, I'm losing it right now, to willingly suspend our disbelief, right? So we could just be like, oh, I accept it, and here we go. Oh, now we're somewhere else. I'm with you, right? So we just want to keep them with us,
right?
Because that's where all the fun is. And he doesn't give us a lot of time. He just shifts gears. New place. Here we go. Oh, next one. Here we go. And so it's, you know, part fantasy and a little bit of you know, a blends of comedy, and some things are absurd, and then some deep philosophical explorations as well about the human mind and spirit, as much as they've been traveling all over the world and discovered all the physical places. I think they talk about self-awareness a lot, and self-exploration and their own growth. They talk about becoming phenomenologists. And I think that's one of the important messages then we're left with, right, is not just who we are individually, but who we are as a collective, too, and who we can become.
And I was going to ask you, how does one enjoy this play? Because, or how should one ideally experience it? Because, of course, there are plenty of people who probably prefer to go to a play in which they are following every thread of the plot and are taking in everything on a very sort of literal level. And I think what you're saying is this is not that kind of play.
Correct.
This is a play in which you're taken on something of a wild ride, an unpredictable ride, and you just have to, at the moment you walk in the door, you need to be ready for that and willing to embrace that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think since 85, you know, we've encountered more theater like this, but it still seems a little experimental and really fresh and especially open to more interpretation. In 85, they didn't have projections. Mm. And of course, some of the things that he writes about that are so period specific about the future and stuff have changed in these 39 years, almost 40 years. So that's kind of the fun. So just being open to it, and I don't think the conventions are too hard to follow, and I think they're kind of fun. And if you just readily accept it, you're gonna enjoy it.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So Ani Gabar, I assume you have built all of your costumes by now. So are you just sitting around enjoying it, or is there still work that you are doing in these last few days?
There's definitely still work that I'm doing. Most of my work now revolves around working with my crew and getting them prepared to do the show and get all those costume changes down quickly. So that's a lot of the work that I'm doing right now, as well as sitting in tech rehearsals, giving notes to actors about, oh, I want this to have more significance or whatever.
I suppose just the way they use a costume and move in a costume can make a difference. So,
yeah.
And you are on repair detail, I should assume, as well, if something goes wrong. But
yeah, if something goes wrong, I'm there to fix it.
Very good. Well, we trust that nothing will go wrong. And Katie Leyendecker, what remains now to be done in these next couple of rehearsals before you open Friday night?
I mean, it's a lot of just getting the actors ready. And, you know, we've been working on it since, what, the beginning of February. So it's really letting them know, like, we can do this, we've got this. I think that's another thing where, like, being the peer really comes in handy, because I can kind of, not to be like good cop bad cop between me and Herschel, but I think there are some of those different perspectives we have in age. So it's a lot more, I'm so used to this, like, opening week jitters kind of thing, that I think I can really kind of try and help calm them down. And it's still putting together some of the final product of my dramaturgical work so that the audience can see some of that when they come see it.
Wow. Sounds so exciting and so intriguing in the best sense of the word. The play is On the Verge, or The Geography of Yearning. I love that subtitle, by Eric Overmeyer. The director, Professor Herschel Kruger, the assistant director, Katie Leyendecker, the costume designer, Ani Gabauer. It opens Friday night. It runs the next two weekends. Mm-hmm. Professor Kruger, if people want to purchase tickets, what do they do?
Yeah, you can call 262-551-6661. So the box office is open most afternoons, I think Tuesday through Friday. But if you leave a message, they can get back to you, 262-551-6661. Or you could visit our website, carthage.edu/theater, and there's a Get Tickets tab right there on the page, so you can get tickets online, carthage.edu/theater.
Very good. Thank you to all three of you for joining us today on The Morning Show, and best wishes to the cast and crew of On the Verge.
Great. Thank you, Greg.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it is the first official Morning Show visit of Kaylin Polamaris. She is, in the sense, the new Nan Calvert. She'll be helping to create, once a month, a Morning Show centered around environmental issues of one kind or another. We'll be talking about maple sugaring tomorrow with Kaylin Polamaris and one of her colleagues from Hawthorne Hollow. On Friday, we are excited about the first Morning Show visit of Dr. Lynn Akey, who is the Chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And next week, we look forward to a visit from Dr. John Swallow, who is the president of Carthage College. Our forecast today is for sunshine this morning, a few clouds later in the day, actually a 30% chance of rain by the end of the day, a high temperature today of 63 degrees, our overnight low of 43 degrees with more rain developing, and tomorrow looks to be a cloudy, rainy day with a high of just 50 and a little cooler than that on Friday, but sunshine will return. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva, NPR.